KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
PR's Wendy Kaufman tells us starting tomorrow, the hourly minimum wage there will rise from the current $9.04 an hour to $9.19.
The minimum wage is going up to reflect an increase in the cost of living index as measured by the federal government. Washington is one of 10 states which pegs its wage floor to inflation. The federal minimum wage is now $7.25. Congress has not voted an increase since 2007. All states must pay their workers at least the federal minimum. 18 states, plus the District of Columbia, have rates higher than that. In addition to Washington, the states with the highest minimum wages include Oregon, Vermont, Connecticut, Illinois, and Nevada. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
For the first time in the history of the parade, a float honoring troops who fought in Korea will be part of Pasadena's Tournament of Roses. The Defense Department is behind the float to be covered with flowers and designed as a replica of the Korean War Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The entry of the float coincides with impending events marking the 60th anniversary of the July 1953 armistice. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org.
Now there's a blast from the past, yes? Welcome to Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Well, blasts from the past are what New Year's Eve Day shows are all about. We take a look back at what we accomplished, what we experienced, as a way to clear the decks and look ahead. Now, you know we changed our show a lot over this last year. We turned to many more interviews and news stories, many more topics per hour. So, to acknowledge that, and because I get to pretend to be Casey Kasem, we bring you the Weekday Countdown, a survey of the year in about 3 minutes and 30-second increments. That's about the right length for a pop song, right? So we're going to play the hits of 2012 on Weekday. We start in January because the year began with questions over class tensions, the rise of Occupy, politics taking shape in the Republican Party. It was thought that gay marriage opponents would be gathering signatures to outlaw same-sex marriage. Education funding was a top priority in Olympia. Fallout from the state Supreme Court ruling that the state was underfunding education. Climate change seemed to be starting to move out of the arena of controversy back into the realm of data-driven science. The organized efforts by opponents to cast doubt on the data seemed to be losing steam. Peter Ward, a UW scientist who studies extinctions and how rapidly the climate can change, joined us.
You've just hit the single most important question. How rapid was rapid? And this is what a lot of people have really been trying to figure out, is when we had these past rises from these big volcanic events, if you would have sat back for 1,000 years, zero and 1,000 years later, how would that compare to what we've done, say, from the year 1000 AD till now? Look, because we've been, you know, people have been putting these, more and more humans burn more trees and eventually more coal, and up goes the greenhouse gases.
When you were talking about greenhouse extinctions, what was the main point you wanted to get across?
It was, what do they do and what are the kill mechanisms? So the kill mechanisms are first heat. The world gets very hot, but one of the funny things about physics is that the poles heat up a lot faster than the equator. We're seeing this today. You know, a lot of news stories about, oh my gosh, the Amazon is so hot now. But the news stories you see are Arctic ice, that the polar ice is shrinking, that it's warmer. Because just the planet warms faster at the high latitudes than the low.
New York Times wrote an article, a fearful article, about the melting of the permafrost and the release of the more dangerous methane gas a couple weeks ago.
And methane is a terrible, terribly efficient greenhouse gas. But within 20 years, methane turns to carbon dioxide. So it's all CO2 eventually.
I see.
But our problem with that is that it slows down the currents. When the poles are warm and the equator's warm, there's nothing to cause current movement. There's nothing to cause wind. What really drives currents now is the cold poles and the warm equator. Wind moves because it's hot there and it's cold there, and so the ocean current. So if you turn off the heat differential everything slows down. When it slows down, the oceans go stagnant. And when the oceans go stagnant, a very different type of microbes take over, which produce as a respiration, because you lose oxygen, they produce hydrogen sulfide. So this conference was about how fast does this take place? How bad is the hydrogen sulfide? This is a very, very poisonous type of gas. And is there any relevance to anything in the past to the present and the future? I mean, that's pretty much what we're banging away on.
What'd you answer?
There seems to be a lot of relevance. And again, just the fact that we're now seeing that the rate of rise is faster now than any time in Earth history would suggest that the rate at which this process changes from our highly oxygenated planet to one in which the oceans start really losing their oxygen at the bottom, that rate's going to increase. And so there is a lot of fearful interest.
All right. Now, I am frightened when you tell me that the deniers are going to say, oh, you're again raising the spectrum of things that are not proven by science.
Well, one of the really, again, this is for scientists. This wasn't for the public. It was scientists talking to scientists. And so a lot of graphs went up, and the pictures there were showing the times when the Earth had high carbon dioxide and what was the sea level then compared to times like now. I mean, still anomalously low for if you take the whole sweep of Earth history. And we have ice caps. Well, when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, which is at 390 now, so just 2.5 times or so what we are now, there seems to never have been large ice caps on the planet, which means the sea level was always 300 to 400 feet higher than it is now.
And stagnant and full of hydrogen sulfide.
So we are at 390 and rising 2 per year, and 1,000 seems to be in deep time when things have really been stinky and awful. I mean, you could call it flatulence Earth.
Peter Ward, professor of biology at UW, his latest book is The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, having time for many more topics allowed us to talk to more artists more often and to explore the creative process. Amy Tan has been writing about how to make a space for creativity in our lives. The best-selling author was in town in January to give a lecture titled Creative Minds Do Not Think Alike. She talks about asking all types of questions, but I wondered how important the answers were.
It's important to have answers, and it has to do with almost a gestalt or a sense of recognition, but that's not all. So the ambiguity can come up when suddenly I'm faced with a different situation and I look at again that same question. But in the writing of it, I can't leave the story with complete ambiguity. I have to have a sense, a transformation. And I think I can explain it better with poetry, that you have something that is building. And at some point in the poem, it turns, what we call it turns, and it suddenly merges together and you have a feeling. For me, it's I have to exhale, right? You feel lifted with the kind of poetry that I tend to read. Billy Collins is one of those that lifts me out of my mind and I see something different. I feel something. That I feel something different. And that is what I need to reach when I'm writing a novel, only in a long form.
You know, we had a wonderful workshop this week with the actor Stephen Tobolowsky about storytelling. And he asked, and to get the juices flowing, to get people thinking along the lines of what you're talking about, he asked these questions. And one of the questions he asked was a question that I thought, I'm sure it's asked in acting classes and writing classes, but it was a tough one. What's the most beautiful sight you've ever seen? And could you answer that question?
Whenever I'm asked by somebody what is the most, what is the best, what is the worst, I don't have an absolute answer because it changes according to who I am at that moment. I'm not saying that just because I'm a writer. I cannot think of what it is. I could say the most beautiful thing is when somebody went up to a stranger and connected, not gave them money, but said something as though they knew that person. There's a connection. That is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. That day, my experience, what I was thinking about, because I was thinking about how are we connected. That would be the most beautiful thing. It doesn't lessen it, because now I have seen something else, observed something else that I felt on another time that was more beautiful. It often has to do with feelings, and it's best if, or not best, but it's lanyap. It's a little extra if you're in a beautiful place, of course.
We are counting down the year chronologically by dipping into the weekday vault. That was Amy Tan from January. Her new book is The Valley of Amazement. Now, speaking of creativity, who better exemplifies that than the Flying Karamazov brothers? They have juggled just about everything since 1973. They even juggle on the radio. Dmitry Karamazov, or Paul McGid, is the director and producer of the Flying Karamazov brothers. He co-founded it in 73. He's also a playwright. Zosima Karamazov, a.k.a. Stephen Bent, is a Bellevue native who saw the Karamazov show at the age of 13, and now he's part of the group. Bent says he is part of their ongoing legacy of keeping the art form alive.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the show here in Seattle at ACT Theater when I was 13, and it was the best day of my life. It was the most fun I'd ever had as an audience member, and it made me want to go do that.
Do you have people coming up to you now saying the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, just yesterday I was giving a kid a juggling lesson after the show, and it was like, whoa, that I remember that in the same lobby where they were helping me figure it out. So,
Flying Karamazov Brothers make music with juggling. Is that fair to say? Music with the tools of juggling. Can you do you make music with those pins?
Oh, yeah. Kind of a challenge. Is that what you're
throwing down?
Yeah. We can make music. We'll do. I think it's part of a piece that we call Rhythm One.
You can do it in this room without
with our cans. I'm going to wear the cans.
Yeah, sure.
And do it
with the headphones.
Yeah.
All right, I like. Yeah, that's good.
So I'm going to just do what's called the regular rhythm. This is in 5/4, okay, and
I'll do a counter rhythm.
And he's going to do a counter rhythm. All right, so I'll start off, and you can hear it. Can you hear that on the radio?
Yeah, I think so.
So you hear that rhythm.
Nice. And then sometimes on stage you have electronics that enhance the sound as well, right?
Well, we've taken this, of course, to the nth degree. So, yeah, we've built suits that are filled with drum triggers. We the farthest we took it was we did a collaboration with MIT, and they said, you know, what do you want to have built? What do you want to have built? And we built this thing where basically it wasn't really juggling, but you had to move in space in order to make the music, right? So the computer would know where you were on the stage, and each place that you stood was a note, right? And it was this huge hexagram with six different octaves in it, and each hexagram side had 12 notes in it, right? And you would step on that space on that note, and then you would make a gesture with accelerometers, and that would trigger the note. So you had to move through, you had to dance basically to play the music.
Didn't you bring some of that to Seattle? Yeah,
we did. The problem was that no one believed that we were actually doing it, because it's like the emperor, you know, with clothes, you know, new clothes. Because it's like you make the gesture and you do the thing, and the better you did it, the less people believed that you
the
actually.
The more it looked like you were just moving to a recording.
Well, yeah, they thought we were doing a recording.
Yeah.
So then we were like, okay, we're screwing up here. You know, we did that on purpose. So you know, like. They still didn't believe us.
To this day, all the appear screw ups are all intentional.
Paul McGid and Stephen Bent, members of the Flying Karamazov Brothers, performed at ACT Theater in February. We're counting down the year. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. As the end of the year approaches, we've been hearing a lot of programs about the big stories of the year, like this one. But what about the big news in your life in 2012? Perhaps it was a birth, a death, a new job, or a big move. KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls at noon, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. What did 2012 mean to you? Call us right now, 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets. PCC embraces the winter season with organic Rio Star grapefruit, fresh winter greens, and hearty soups with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com.
We have cloudy skies and 38 degrees in the U District. Forecast calls for clouds all day, chance of rain, the high in the upper 30s. It's going to be cloudy and cold tonight, chance of showers, the low in the low 30s. We're expecting some morning fog tomorrow, otherwise cloudy all day, the high in the low 40s.
You're listening to Weekday, a special edition. We're counting down the hits by counting down the year chronologically. We juggled a lot of news in February. The proposal to build a coal terminal at Cherry Point near Bellingham was garnering attention. Governor Gregoire signed the same-sex marriage equality bill into law. Opponents sought an initiative to stop the law from taking effect. A public-private proposal for a new basketball arena grabbed the headlines. And an authorized biography of General David Petraeus, All In, was published. The author was Paula Broadwell. Later in the year, of course, Petraeus had to resign from the CIA after his affair with his biographer, Paula Broadwell, was revealed. Here's what she was talking about back then.
We profile in the book how Petraeus learns he's not getting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff position.
Yeah, and bummed about that.
He was. He was disappointed that he wasn't considered, but he had mixed feelings because he knew that the next step for the military was to draw down, was to face these billion-dollar budget cuts, and painful. You know, they're very painful, this internecine fighting between the services over who cuts what. He can do that. He's a manager. He's an effective manager, but he loves to be a warfighter. And so he proposes to Secretary Gates that he be considered for CIA. He thought he would be able to stay in uniform. And I think that was really important to him at the time. But the president embraces that idea. I don't think the White House wanted Petraeus as chairman because he is a larger-than-life figure. He is willing to push the envelope and not you know, cross the line of insubordination. But there was that concern. And now, to answer your question, I think the two of them work very closely. Petraeus is out traveling the world, occasionally meeting with heads of state, and I don't think the president would have one of his senior leaders doing that if he didn't trust him to serve as his emissary, if you will. And he's, you know, as the president has kind of encouraged this shift from large-scale boots-on-the-ground operation to more covert wars, and where intelligence is, you know, it's important, intelligence drives operations. He recognizes the value that Petraeus brings to the table as a former consumer of that intelligence. And he has asked for the agency's perspective, the president has, but he has invited Petraeus to give his personal perspective if it contrasts with his analysts and so forth. So I think he does respect that this individual is well-informed and can help the president.
Throughout this book, you reveal clearly that Petraeus sees his work as political in the broadest sense of the term. That as a soldier, he is enmeshed in society and the culture, and so, you know, he's a scholar, he's a statesman, he's a soldier. And of course, people are looking at this and looking at his career, seeing somebody who has moved his way up. You even talk about him being the most well-regarded or well-known general since Eisenhower. I can't remember the comparison you made, but clearly we all get the comparison, and people are asking you this, I know. But what do you think the next step is for David Petraeus if he wants to stay engaged mm-hmm. like he wanted to in the CIA mm-hmm. before he clearly, you know, would have to do something else to enter politics? What's his next step, do you think?
Well, first of all, I don't think he'll enter politics.
You don't?
I don't. No. A lot of people think he's obviously, as I said, very ambitious, very driven to be the best in everything he can. But number one, he loves being a warfighter, and I think he feels he can be more effective in the type of service capacity he's in now.
I know. He quotes Teddy Roosevelt a lot.
He does. He does. But, you know, his favorite quote of Teddy Roosevelt is that what matters most is the man who's in the arena marred by blood and sweat and dirt, not the critic who writes from his armchair in Washington, D.C. or so forth.
Yeah, but presidents are not. Yeah, okay. Go
ahead. No. But he Number one, he enjoys the capacity he's serving in very much. He'd love to stay at the agency for many years, he says. He's in love with the workforce there. I think he you know, is used to dealing with kind of the brawns of the military, and now he's got the brains. And there's brains and brawns in both organizations, obviously. But at the end of the day, he's kind of a professor. He loves academic work. He loves the cerebral problem sets that he has to deal with now. And he loves the interagency aspect of it. And he's always been kind of seen himself as an engine of change. And I hope one thing he brings to the intelligence community, which is 16 different organizations, is a more coherent interagency process, because we have to have a whole of government approach to avoid another 9/11.
Well, of course, that's his goal, right? That's one of his charges,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. So the other reason he won't run for office is his wife is not interested in it. She's a very private person, Holly Petraeus, and she has sacrificed a lot while he's been deployed for 8 years, and I think, you know, he's respectful of her request.
Well, the resonance things have over time. That's Paula Broadwell, who was David Petraeus's biographer, and as we found out later in the year, something more. By February, people were already noticing the spike in shootings and killings in the city. People were asking just how deep was the distrust between some citizens and the police. On March 1st, we talked to Rick Williams, whose brother, John T. Williams, was shot by a Seattle police officer. Williams and his family and friends responded with a totem pole they carved and put up at Seattle Center. We met him there.
In my mind and heart, I knew where the law was going to go, how they were going to handle this. I knew they'd find a prettier broom to sweep this, because none of them were man enough to stand up the way my family did. Speaking for my family, that the honor was everything to us and heritage, that what my father, my grandfather, and great-grandfather did here in Seattle for just about 100 years now. My question to them was, how can you say that this Mr. Ian Burke, 2 years, 7 months on the street, was able to play God at that moment, and thinking no one will stand up for this man. I knew John better than anybody. I knew what he liked, disliked. His favorite things were little things that people take for granted. You know, we know out here what the law says. The lawman broke the law. The lawman used the law to protect himself. To me, he covered up a great lie. Is this all going to be said, or are you going to edit like everybody else does?
No. You're saying it. What do you mean by a great lie? We're not going to edit it.
Great lie? How is it any different the last 600 years? Look at my brother walking down the street. Everybody in Seattle that grew up with us knew him. They showed the last week of my brother's life on paper, TV. They showed only what they wanted, never the truth about my brother carving for four presidents like my whole family did here in Seattle. Carved for Smithsonian museums around the world for things that we all created, and took my brother's life, and it wasn't his time, man.
No.
Murder's murder.
You know, but you responded with a gift.
Yes, sir. As the carvers that I started this, a lot were hurt and angered, and some said they didn't like my calm or the way I handle it. And I feel sad lately that some natives are angry at me for the way I handle this, not knowing what I was taught and the teaching I grew up with. It made me open my mind and heart to handle it proudly for my brother, because he was a great man, you know, that this will be in history, that in my mind and heart, I hope people always talk about this, because if you've seen the video to this,
no,
how was he a threat? None of us, everybody, and everywhere I go, people say their condolences to me, and I thank them for it. That what they saw in the video, they weren't scared, but Ian Burke's thoughts. Well, that's his choice he made. I feel bad for him. I forgave the department. I forgave Burke. But
nope.
Still nothing's done. they used all their resources to protect him. Weren't man enough to see me, face me, talk to me.
Burke?
Yes. I asked for a time to where the lawyers and I get together with the union, Rich O'Neill. Everybody that protected him, I wanted to meet them once. My friend, the lawyer, asked me, what I say? Nothing. It's just my right to see them. It doesn't matter if I see them now because they proved who they truly are. And what I find sad is us taxpayers that pay them to protect and serve. How does that make you think, feel?
That's Carver Rick Williams, whose brother John T. Williams was killed by a Seattle police officer. You can see that totem pole still standing in front of the Space Needle. Public safety has been a top issue this year, culminating in an agreement between the city and the Department of Justice to implement major reforms. A judge and a monitor are overseeing the effort. When a shooting occurred at Maya's restaurant in the neighborhood, Mayor Mike McGinn and Deputy Police Chief Nick Metz said there was an emergency occurring. The murder rate for the first few months of the year was higher than last year at the same time. So in mid-March, producer Jason Pagano, Brian Buckaloo, and I walked around the Rainier Beach neighborhood with members of the Rainier Beach Block Watch.
My name's Nico Okamoto, and right now we're looking at the Stone House, which was seized by the city finally after decades of drug users living there, a landlord that I think was also involved in dealing drugs. And it was a source of a lot of trouble for, you know, for all of the neighbors here.
How so?
All the traffic that it brought, bad people, you know, breaking in, assaults, prostitution.
I'm Julie, and we're looking at the Stone House, which is all boarded up. This is a very eclectic neighborhood with different style houses, so it's a bit older of a house. And if you didn't know any different, you would think it was just a regular house in the neighborhood. It has a fence around it. And the owner of the house, had about 30 or 40 active residents who had addresses listed there. And a lot of them had criminal activity and were drug addicted. And the neighbors in this area reported that they absolutely can hardly live in their houses at the time because there was, you know, a lot of drug activity going on and also active prostitution around the property itself. So
when did it get shut down?
It got shut down probably maybe May of last year under an abatement process.
Was there a dramatic change when it got shut down? Either one of you two who...
Oh, this is Margie. There was for a while, but, you know, drug addicts only know what they know. And so there's been continued attempts to get back in this house as recent as last week, trying to break back in because they have nowhere to go. They still think there's going to be some drugs hidden in that house. So it's a constant process to make sure it stays boarded up and those people are forced to go somewhere else.
Now, is that pretty standard, and any one of you can answer this, is that pretty standard that there's a handful of bad houses that attract certain elements, or is it more diffuse?
You know, it's hard. This is Margie. I don't know, but I can tell you what really upsets me is there's a house that we passed coming down even this block, and that house is sold every year, and it's because people move in. They think they're moving into a wonderful, established neighborhood. And between the crime and the noise and the sirens and the hovering helicopters, they can't take it. They can't go for walks. They can't do it. So they continue to move out. And what that causes is that's what where all these meth houses and all these kids breaking in and squatters coming in and taking over property. And, you know, so I really cannot tell you, you know, looking at the houses for sale, if they're a problem. I mean...
So, Julie and Nico, you guys have both lived here for how long?
I've lived here for 13 years in this neighborhood.
About 20 in my home and on the other side of Seward Park,
for another 5. This is Julie, and I've lived here for less than a year. Okay. Yeah, so I'm one of the newer residents in the neighborhood. And, you know, again, had I known when I moved down here some of these issues that go on, I may have thought twice about buying my house.
Why did you move down here?
I'm a social worker by profession, and so I like to live in a more mixed neighborhood, both with incomes and diversity, and it's an affordable neighborhood for me, but yet I can still get to downtown Seattle where I work, and there's just a really friendly vibe down here. So, you know, I'm committed to being down here, and I used to live more in the Central District area where they also have some problems with gang violence and, you know, people getting assaulted on the street, but it's a different problem down here. And I think part of that might be because up in the Central District Capitol Hill area, there's so many people on the streets walking to different businesses and things like that, that you have to be pretty bold and brazen to attack somebody when there's other people around here or around there. But in our neighborhood, you know, we don't have one real central business area, and people, you know, a lot of people don't like to be out after 10 around here, not even in their car, just because, you know, you don't know what goes on around after dark around here.
Rainier Beach Block Watch members Margie, Julie, and Nico talking to KUW Weekday producer Brian Buckaloo. In March, the debris from Japan's tsunami was washing ashore in April. A special session ended in Olympia. Senator Murray was holding hearings at Joint Base Lewis-McChord about the way Madigan Army Hospital was treating soldiers diagnosed with PTSD. Mitt Romney was on a winning streak and other contenders were dropping out. Trayvon Martin's shooter was arrested following public protests. Catholic bishops called for rolling back the same-sex marriage law and also criticized a nuns group for not following policy. The Space Needle celebrated its 50th anniversary, and we celebrated the incredible human brain with Allen Institute scientist Christoph Koch. He studies the physical brain and how consciousness manifests itself. I wondered what I would see in his lab.
Well, I can put you in a magnetic scanner and I can show you which part of your brain are specifically active when you're conscious of something. You have to realize that most of your brain activity does not give rise to consciousness, right? We know ever since Sigmund Freud, he was one of the first to point this out, most of the stuff in your head you'd have no conscious access to. When I talk to you, these Germanic sentences, sort of somehow these utterances translate into meanings, but you don't have access to the level of the phonemes, how they're processed in the brain. When you look out, suddenly you see the world in color within a fraction of a second, but you don't, for example, you cannot not see it in gray and white, yet they're part of your brain that analyze the scene in front of your eyes in grayscale, just like an old television. But you don't have access to that. You have access to the fully processed image. You hear, you look at people, you hear sounds, you hear words, and all of that is hidden from you. It's like an operating system, and the real work is all done below the skin of the operating system. That's all done in the unconscious. You have very powerful emotions. You love some people, you might hate some people. You don't really know why. All you know, you have these emotions, but you don't have access to the part of the brain that generates these emotions. And so we know most of the things you do, most of the daily habits in your life are patterned by these unconscious things. So most of the parts of your brain are off limits to consciousness. Only some parts seem to have a close association with consciousness.
You write in this book about, you write about free will and determinism. You write about, I was reading part of this book while I was on the bus, and you were writing about the morning routine, and I was thinking about my morning routine while I did it. How much of that is that consciousness? Is that, or am I just determined by my actions, my habits?
Okay, so that's a separate question. The question, to what extent are you free? Are you truly free? And what do we mean by that? So that's a question, an independent question of the question of consciousness. You may well be totally, fully determined, yet that doesn't really answer the question of consciousness. Or you might have free will. Again, that leaves the question of what is consciousness and what is it constituted unanswered. So those are really two separate questions, the question of free will and the question of consciousness.
Well, I would like you to explain why. Couldn't I only have free will if I had a strong understanding of my consciousness, that I was conscious?
No, you can well imagine. I mean, if you observe animals, if you observe a beagle, a dog, or boys, or a bunch of bees, they all behave pretty random, right? They do these random things. I mean, certainly if you ask teenagers, they do things. You ask them why, well, I just felt like it, right? They have no idea why they do it. That the boys are clearly conscious. And so if you look at bees or you look at beagles, they run around and do all sorts of crazy things, and they seem to be well, they seem to be free. They don't seem to be determined. So why does it only have to be us? So the question of you may well not be fully conscious, yet you still do things that seem to be undetermined.
I walk my dog down the street, and he has to stop every 5 feet and smell something. I don't think he makes that choice.
No, but you
His nose makes that choice.
No, that's correct. But you also, most of the things that you do, from the colors you pick, from the foods you eat, are sort of predetermined, from the things you believe. Most people believe what their parents believe. Do you really think that's a free choice? At 18 says, well, I could be Catholic, I could be Protestant, I could be Muslim, I could be Jewish, but I freely now decide I'm Catholic. No, you believe what your parents believe. How much freedom is that? Most of the things you do in your life, the newspapers you read, the way you tie your shoes, the way the way you reach out and shake somebody's hand, unconscious and shaped by untold patterns you exercise in your throughout your lifetime. So most of the things you do automatically, you do unthinkingly.
That's Christoph Koch. He's a professor of biology. He's the chief scientific officer of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. His new book is Consciousness, Confession of a Romantic Reductionist, part of our countdown of 2012, which continues in a moment.
We have cloudy skies and 36 degrees in Seattle's University District. Forecast calls for clouds all day, chance of showers, the high in the upper 30s. It's going to be cloudy tonight as well, chance of rain and fairly cold, the low near 33. We're expecting morning fog tomorrow, cloudy skies throughout the day, the high in the low 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from the International Rescue Committee, committed to leading the way from harm to home for millions threatened and uprooted by war, disaster, and persecution in the U.S. and around the world. More at rescue.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 9:41.
Today on Weekday, we are counting down the old year. We continue in April. The campaign to legalize marijuana was in full swing. John McKay, former U.S. attorney, was a high-profile supporter of the successful campaign for Initiative 502. Towards the end of April, he was arguing for a regional, cross-border vision of the drug trade.
You know, the RCMP estimated to me when I was United States attorney that the value of the marijuana produced annually in Lower British Columbia was between $4 and $6 billion. But you know what? That's not the street value of the marijuana that's grown up there. That's just the value to the growing organizations, to the Asian gangs, to the Hells Angels. The street value probably approaches $30 billion a year. And that makes it the number one industry in British Columbia by far. And so, you know, I don't want your listeners to misunderstand that I'm somehow blaming the Canadians, as if this were some episode of South Park. I'm not. This is created by the enormous demand for marijuana, mostly in the United States, where we have millions and millions of Americans who, in the face of criminal penalties, smoke marijuana regularly. That's what creates the market. But I think the allure of the extra income that seems to be easily made there by growing marijuana is just too much, and the market too great. But the market force is the same. It is the demand for marijuana by people who have chosen to smoke marijuana, mostly adults, probably far too many of our youth, but the demand for marijuana being huge. I think that's a corruption in both of our societies, that we've got this kind of a disrespect, that we're willing to indulge our habit to a point that we kind of close our eyes to the human toll. The folks who are opposing the failed marijuana policies in Canada, in other words, our counterparts up there who are saying, let's look at marijuana from a public health approach. Let's stop trying to arrest our way out of dealing with the problem, regulate it, tax it, and then educate people on a public health model. There are many active people now in Canada. You know who's leading the effort up there? It's very interesting. It's not the lawyers. It's not even the politicians. The politicians are starting to come on board in British Columbia and I think around Canada. It's the doctors. And you know why? It's because the emergency room doctors now in the last 10 years are finding their emergency rooms filled with people with gunshot wounds. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of easy arrangement that existed back in the early 2000s doesn't exist up there anymore. They're shooting each other over the huge profits spawned by the American marijuana market.
John McKay, former U.S. attorney and a supporter of the successful Initiative 502 to legalize marijuana in the state. May started out with May Day Havoc, a rock thrown through Mayor McGinn's window, the fate of a Chinese dissident in doubt, the search for a Seattle school superintendent. Vice President Biden spoke out in favor of same-sex marriage on the Sunday talk shows, forcing the president to come out in support a few days later. While the pro basketball arena debate took shape, the Seattle Sounders women played soccer to sell out crowds. Marcy Silman talked to players Michelle French and Megan Manthe about women's pro soccer.
Right now, as a starting point, I think Seattle's doing a great job of creating an environment where players want to play, developing the right organization around it, and then being able to draw in the players that, you know, people recognize. And then once we are able to do that, we'll be able to create a little bit more momentum in regards to, you know, really developing a base where, you know, women's soccer is seen as something important and something that can influence not only young kids, but be a part of, you know, an entire family's life. So I'd like to see it develop into a sustainable professional league. We've tried it a couple times, but the models unfortunately haven't worked. So I think Seattle is starting to put the right foot forward to develop that.
I was told that there was I think it was a WPS team in Los Angeles that featured the top world soccer players, and even that they couldn't make a go of it. Is it the business model? Is it just that fans aren't ready to pay to see women athletes play?
No, I definitely think the fan base is there, and it's never been about the support that they weren't able to get. I think it's just, and without knowing too much, I think it's more so the business model than anything.
Megan Manthe, what about you when you think ahead, because you're pretty young, may I ask, under 25?
23.
Yeah. And when you took that job in Denmark right out of college, what were you anticipating for yourself as an athlete?
I was going over there. It was actually really difficult to find a team coming straight out of college, not having national team experience and not being a high-profile player, but being someone who really just has a passion to play the game and loves, you know, I love what I do. So when I was going over there, I was just looking for a way where I was able to have a salary and, you know, start a savings and that kind of thing, and be able to continue doing what I love to do, with the hopes of there being a league to come back to in the States, you know, after some time over in Europe, you know, something to come home to.
What does it do for you as an athlete to play with the caliber of players that Seattle Sounders now have amassed?
I'm really looking forward to it because I think it's going to give me the opportunity to really improve as a player myself. When you're surrounded by people who have played at a higher level, I think it's easier to kind of go and play up with them and learn from them. And I just know after one practice of playing with Alex Morgan, it was just, I was so excited after because she could just finish every ball I played into her. And so I'm just really looking forward to it.
Megan Manthe, Michelle French talking to Marcy Silman. Seattle Sounders women's 2013 season starts this April. The month of May ended with the city turning its attention towards guns and gun violence again. Madrona dad Justin Ferrari was shot and killed while driving his kids to a swim practice. At Seattle Center, a bystander shot in the leg by a gang member firing at another gang member. 4 drive-by shootings in South Seattle. And on May 30th, a gunman killed 4 people at Cafe Racer in Seattle's U District and a woman in a parking lot on First Hill. We asked for your reactions.
I think there's obviously things that you can learn from these instances, and they're very unfortunate. But the reality is we're very insulated from the fact that violence is a constant. It's part of human nature. And there's things you can do to mitigate it, but it's an absolute reality.
Violence is a constant in our society, but making handguns harder to get, I think, is a mature and honest way to address the violence in our society. And we need to not be afraid to have that conversation that we need tighter control of handguns and not be cowed by the NRA. So now's the time to have that conversation, and it can start in Seattle, and I'm ready.
I think we should reconsider how easily I could go in and buy a pistol at one of these gun shows or even buy a rifle and then walk down the aisle and buy the mechanism to make it fully automatic.
There's basically no way that a person can, who's not allowed to legally own a firearm, can go to a gun show and get a firearm, period. I don't think that the red herring of the gun show should be a part of the conversation. I think we should just be able to talk about what about firearm sales, you know, in stores in Washington State.
My opinion is there will always be mentally ill people, there will always be impulsive people, there will always be angry, violent people, and the damage that can be done with a gun versus a knife or something can only be controlled by getting the guns off the street.
I personally feel that we should have a conversation about licensure, because I actually do feel like if we're going to ask people to get a license to be able to safely operate a car, that we should definitely make sure that people take the same kind of training to be able to safely own and responsibly own and operate a firearm.
By the end of the year, we saw the violence continuing around the country, and maybe that discussion is going to take place in earnest in 2013. In the first week of June, opponents of same-sex marriage blocked the Washington law that granted those rights, putting the issue to a public vote in November. And the Seattle City Council considered the funding proposal for a new basketball arena. And Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Ford joined us to talk about his new novel, Canada, a book he started working on more than 20 years ago. And he talked about why he always finishes what he starts writing.
I started writing thinking that that was really a hazard to be avoided, which is starting a book and at some point or other failing a faith or hitting a blank wall. I just thought, I ain't going to do that. Whatever I start, finish.
That's an ability to be focused that I'm sure makes you a good writer.
Well, it's mostly, I think, brought about by fear of failure and a terror of what would happen if I were to hit that wall and not be able to carry on. Yeah, I think fear of failure for me has always been a prime motive.
Wait, did you set out writing and have no other career? Have no other job?
I had many failures right behind me, but I had no other fallback. But I did have something better than that. I had a wonderful girl who loved me, and she thought it was a great idea for me to be a writer. And she said, look, I'll work. You just go up to your room and write these books and shut up.
So, wow.
And I'm still married to her.
And you did it.
Well, I did it. I'm doing it.
But, yeah, you're doing it.
I'm doing it.
You continue to do it.
Dead doesn't really count.
yeah, that's right. What's next? All right, Canada, a novel that you first started in 1989.
I did.
Is that right?
I did. I was living in Little Wheat Prairie Town, north of Great Falls, waiting for some copy-edited manuscript to come back from Knopf, who was my publisher at the time. It was slow. I was just hanging around. Christina and I were going bird hunting in the afternoon, but there were all the yawning mornings when I didn't have anything to do, so I rented a little room above a car repair and wrote 20 pages. And then the pages that I was waiting for from Knopf came back, and I set the whole project aside, and 20 years went by. I kept notes during that time, thinking that I would return to this project, which was called Canada and was about an American boy who was sent across the border to Saskatchewan because his parents had for some reason abandoned him. So when I finished The Lay of the Land, the last novel I published, I thought, well, maybe this is the moment 20 years on.
Did you know all of the plot 22 years ago, or did that come later?
Incrementally, I had filled in some things, but when I had to sit down and get out those notes, which were in my freezer compartment of my refrigerator, when I had a lot of them, too.
I'm sorry, wait. Why do you keep them there?
Well, I had probably a mistaken notion. This is one of those things, you know, what is it, folk wisdom, that if the house burned, the freezer
would.
That's probably not even true. Probably that'd be the first thing. It would explode in some way. I remember when New Orleans, after Katrina, you know, refrigerators became everybody's worst enemy. So I have a conception of a refrigerator as being a place that's safe. It probably isn't.
So a little more. Anyway, tell a little more about this story.
I hauled out my notes, many, many, many notes, kept over those 20-plus years, and just started to fill in the things that I didn't know. I didn't know why two parents would abandon their son. So I had to dream up robbing a bank. I didn't know who would take this boy across the border, so I had to invent a character, Mildred. I invented a sister. I just kind of figged out the whole thing that would be something you would normally do in writing a novel. When you get a sort of idea for how a novel might perform, and then you spend a year, I would anyway, and did, filling out all of the lineaments and the ligatures of its life.
Novelist Richard Ford exploring creativity with us in 2012. By mid-June, Rob McKenna and Jay Inslee had met for their first political debate, and the University of Washington Board of Regents passed a 16% tuition increase. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz was in town, reflecting on the Great Recession and arguing that financial inequality between the rich, the middle class, and the poor is not just expensive, but unsustainable.
The economic slowdown, the recession, caused the deficit. It wasn't the other way around. And the best way to deal with the deficit is to put America back to work, to restore our economy to full employment. And that means when you have a weak private sector, you need to have government stimulus. When you're focusing on the long run, you want to have investments in education, technology, infrastructure. If you design those investments right, they can create a more equal society. One of the things that most Americans don't realize is that we've become the society, the economy, among the advanced industrial countries with the least equality of opportunity, so different from our self-perception as a land of opportunity. And one of the reasons for that is that we underinvest in these public goods, and particularly in education.
So how does Germany invest in their infrastructure in a way that gives them more equality than the U.S.?
Well, one of the things they do is that they have an education system that is a little bit more tailored to their economy, to the economy of the 21st century. So they have a system that for those kids that are not going to be university stars, they have an apprenticeship program that integrates them into the industrial labor force. It makes their industrial economy very competitive. One of the reasons why the manufacturing in that economy has succeeded. It may not be a way that would work for the United States, but that's an example of how a country can adapt to a changing global economy.
So the response that people have given is that's tracking, and you track the least fortunate, and they're not given in America, and they're not given opportunity.
Well, no, everybody gets an opportunity, but the point is, at some point, you have to say, what is the education appropriate to where this particular kid is going to go? And in a complex economy, you're going to need some people who are going to be doctors, some people who are going to be bankers, some people are going to be researchers, but also some people who are going to be able to work in a factory and be machinists, to be the kind of skilled workers to make an economy competitive.
The United States economy, the people looking at the economy say, right now we're facing a cliff at the end of 2012 where if the Bush tax cuts expire and these spending cuts that are supposed to be put into place are put into place, that we'd go off the cliff. Why would that be, and how does that fit into what you're talking about in terms of what Europeans have done?
Well, the key problem in the United States and in Europe is lack of demand. And when you have massive cutbacks of government expenditures, unless something else can fill us to the place, the economy goes down. You know, if our trading partners were in a boom, you might be able to have exports fill in the gap of government spending. It's not going to happen now. It's not going to happen. So that means that reduction in demand is going to have a disastrous effect. But there are choices. If we decide to have those continue the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy, there's a cost of that. If we took that same money, the same budgetary impact of those tax cuts, and we spent the money on investments in our future, investments in education, technology, and infrastructure, it will do two things. It will stimulate the economy more today, so our unemployment will come down more, and it will provide the basis of long-term economic growth. Those tax cuts for the millionaires don't do that. What those tax cuts do is they build up their balance sheets. It may lead to more cash in their pockets, more investments abroad, but not likely significant more investments here at home.
Economist Joseph Stiglitz. And, of course, the fiscal cliff, political divide between people on how they want to solve the economic crisis continues as 2012 ends. Our look at 2012, our countdown of 2012 through some of the conversations we had with folks, will continue. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle.
Good morning, it's 9:59. I'm Andy Hurst. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
When you consider your year-end charitable giving, please remember KUOW. Gifts of stock and appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For more information, contact us at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.